All right, let's go. So today we have a, I think, interesting class with different opinions and different ideas. The truth is, I'm not an authority to say this is the right way of doing things, this is the wrong way of doing things. My mission in this case is to present different ideas, different possibilities, and I believe each case has to be dealt with independently. That means a person should have, a person, I mean, Jew or not Jewish, actually, it's the same thing. A person should have a guide. And through this guidance, go through with this guidance. Sometimes you're gonna like whatever you get as guidance. Sometimes you're not gonna like it, but has to be like consistent. Of course, just like any doctor, you can say, okay, I don't like this doctor anymore. I want to go to a different doctor. Or sometimes you get different, you want different opinions. If in the things of the body, you need different opinions to see, do you actually make a surgery, don't make a surgery? In the things of the soul, of course, there are many opinions, and sometimes you want to hear different opinions. But once you hear these different opinions, it's important to have a guidance to say, look, I heard this, and that. This rabbi told me this rabbi told me that, this rabbi said this, based on this, and that, what should I do? And according to the level where the person is holding in his connection to God, in his connection to the precepts, mitzvahs, etc., according to that, hopefully, with a lot of in Aramaic, Hebrew, we say sayata dishmaya, with the help of God, with the help of the heaven. So you're gonna get the right guidance, the one that is sent actually for you specifically. That's why it's difficult, many times difficult, to give a class on this particular subject, because people think that whatever you say applies to every case, in every situation, and all the case, and it's tough. It's really tough. And what makes it more difficult, really, this is the main place where the difficulty is, there's not much written about this the issue. If there's a lot of text and then there's a lot of people arguing about this, so you can get the easy way, easy path to understand what the truth is. Let's call it truth, whatever it means. But since there's not so much written about this, and the reason why is very simple, to write about these subjects many years ago, 300 years ago, 500 and back, was virtually death. A rabbi could not publish a book talking about non-Jews because, what are you talking about us? We're gonna kill you. That's it. So we don't have so much written about these issues. And you have to pick and choose, pick here, there, and maybe he wanted to say this or that and start interpreting, and it's not easy. So, what's the subject that we're going to talk about today? The subject is, can non-Jews fulfill the mitzvot, the precepts of Jews? That's the idea I want to present today. Again, there's no right answer or wrong answer. It depends on the case. Actually, one of the, at least I find it, one of the most beautiful things about Judaism and the way of learning of Judaism is, we are in the actually in the Western world. I say we because I live in the Western world also, but whatever, there's all kinds of people, all kinds of places. In the Western world, we're used to binary logic. Either you're right or you're wrong. I'm a person that worked lots many years in computers. I still work in computers, whatever. So ones and zeros, either right or wrong. That's it. It's correct or wrong. No middle path. In when you start really learning Talmud and Judaism and delving into it really deeply, you're gonna find that that's not the right logic. That's not the logic Judaism follows. The logic is both opinions are right, actually. They express different aspects of godliness. Only that in certain cases, godliness shows itself, reveals itself in this way, so you should follow this authority, and in certain different cases, godliness shows itself, reveals itself in a different way. So you should follow this other opinion. So who's right and who's wrong? Both are right. And maybe in some cases, both are wrong. There's a third opinion. Oh, so you go crazy. You don't know where to stand. That's why I say main thing, and the first of all is to have a particular guidance, somebody you can ask, and somebody that can ideally know you, understand you, know a little bit of your story, and say, I think that for your particular case, the answer would be ta-ta-ta, or the path to follow would be pa-pa-pa, etc. It even happens within Judaism, at least, that sometimes a person calls a rabbi with a question, specific question on anything, the rabbi answers the question, and somebody else calls with the same question, and the rabbi answers differently. And then they speak between them, hey, to me the rabbi said yes, and to you the rabbi says no. Are you crazy? The rabbi is crazy. So, wait a second. In this particular case, this is correct. In this particular case, this is not correct. Very simple. And of course, the rabbi should be able to provide the sources. Why do you say this? Okay, you want to say why? We can see it and we can learn. And I'm going to show you why I said why. And of course, this, I shouldn't even say it, but we can make mistakes. Of course, we can make mistakes and we can say, we'll go back and say, okay, I made a mistake. I'm sorry. The answer should be ta-ta-ta, depending on the case. All of this said, let's go into it. I'm not going to read all the sources inside because this would take like 5 hours or even more. So I'm not going to do that. There's one source I want to read, but because actually many of the ideas are based on this source, on how you understand this particular source. This source is called Rambam. Rambam was called Reb Moshe Ben Maimon. He lived in Spain, year 1100s. Yeah, I got stuck with the years. 1100s in Spain. He wrote many things. He was a very, very special person. Definitely. It's a subject on itself. Who was the rabbi, the Rambam, etc. But one of the books he wrote, it's called Yad HaChazaka, in English would be called like the strong hand, because the word hand in Hebrew is called Yad, Yud Dalet, which actually adds up to 14. It's a book, comprises 14 books, so that's why it's called like the 14, strong 14, whatever. Yad HaChazaka, or Mishneh Torah, it's also called that way. There, at the end of the book, he writes, all the laws, I mean all, at least, in quote, all the laws of Bnei Noach. It's the only one that actually writes all the laws of all Judaism at all, from the beginning to the end, so to speak, which includes, of course, the Bnei Noach. And, interestingly speaking about this, he writes the laws of Bnei Noach close, really close. It's like the last four chapters of the whole book, the second to last, so to speak, two speak about Bnei Noach, and the last two speak about Mashiach, Messiah. So it's really connected one thing to the other, because once the whole world, everybody, I mean Jews and non-Jews, understand and live in Mashiach, Messiah, so that's going to actually bring him and reveal God in the earth, etc. So it's actually interesting. The Rambam was very special mind. Even the order in which he wrote things, that has teachings. So here we have a very specific thing in the order. First Bnei Noach, then Moshiach. So what we're doing is actually bringing close the Moshiach. There he writes the following thing. I'm going to read to you inside, just a second. Okay. This is in chapter 10, the law number 9. I'm not going to read the whole law because it talks about other things, which also is a subject on itself. So for a different time, I'm not saying this should not be treated and should not be explained. It should be explained. It talks about Shabbos, Shabbat, talks about the learning of Torah for non-Jews. We can make a class on that. Let's not dwell on that. See, so he writes like this. The general idea is like this. I'm reading it from inside. The chapter 10 of Laws of Kings, and the law is number 9. The general thing is like this. We means like the ruling Jewish court or whatever, that today doesn't exist, or whatever. We don't let them make a chidush. Chidush means like a novelty. We do not allow them to make new religion or to make mitzvot, precepts, by themselves because they want to. What does that mean? Very simple. Let's say a person makes up that taking the cell phone and raising it three times, that is what God says to us that we should do. Everybody starts raising the phone and three times in the day, three times in the morning, three times in the afternoon. Where do you get that from? I don't know. It's nice. It's a cell phone. We don't allow this. You want to call this your religion or whatever religion? Fine. Don't say this is what Judaism teaches. It's not. It's not written anywhere. Again, there are many religions around. Everybody says whatever he wants to say. Islam is there and Buddhism is there. Hinduism, okay, do whatever you want. But don't say that this is a godly commandment to Jews to spread around. No, 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 no. That's not written anywhere. So that's what the Rambam is talking about. We don't let them like invent, make up new ideas. Rather, either you convert and accept all the precepts, all the commandments, all the mitzvot, or you stay in your Torah, in your teachings of seven laws, etc. Don't add anything, don't take out anything. And whomever does anything else also includes Shabbat, resting, I'm not going to dwell into this, or study Torah, we tell them this is wrong and you're going to be punished by God. Next law, number 10. We just read number 9, so don't do anything else than the seven things. This is what the Rambam just said. Number 9. Yeah, I'm sorry, that was number 9. Number 10. Ben Noyach, non-Jew, who wants to do a mitzvah, a precept, of the rest of the mitzvot of the Torah, that means that doesn't include Shabbos, to rest on the seventh day, and does not include learning Torah, which actually we're learning Torah. But don't worry, we're doing something right. So a non-Jew that wants to do something else, something more than what the seven precepts, etc., seven commandments, because he wants to receive reward. This is the exact text that the Rambam writes. He wants to receive reward. It doesn't say which kind of reward. We do not prevent him of doing it properly. That means you want to do it, you have to do it right. What does that mean, right? Just like the laws of the Jews, you have to do it properly. And if he wants to bring, he or she, it's exactly the same thing. If he wants to bring a sacrifice to the temple, we don't have the temple today, we receive the sacrifice. If he wants to give tzedakah, he wants to help somebody else with money, we receive it. And I think we give it to the poor of the Jews. This is basically the main thing. The text continues, but we're not losing anything if I don't explain it. You can find it actually in English, in any language. It's readily available. So this is what the Rambam said. We just said you should not do anything else than the seven things. And then immediately afterwards we say, if you want to do something else, okay, go do it. Do it properly, but go do it. No problem. So what are we saying? Should I do more or should I not do more? What's the conclusion of this? So the idea is very simple. Before explaining this, one comment on the Rambam. I want to tell you, this is the last source we're going to read. One comment. This comment, what did I do? This comment is from the Radvaz. The Radvaz was called David Ben Zimri. Where did I put it? Okay, I don't find it here right now, but whatever, I'm going to tell you outside. The Radvaz was called David Ben Zimri. He lived in Egypt, years 1500s. He was the teacher of the Arizal. Arizal was a great Kabbalist. So we're talking about the teacher of him, a great guy, very, very impressive mind. So the Radvaz writes, what is this thing of doing precepts because he wants to receive reward? We know that there's such a thing as God commanding you to do something and you do it, or God not commanding you to do something and you do it anyway. You do it anyway because you want to do it, you want to whatever, do more than what you're supposed to be doing. These two ideas, Jews have 613 commandments. That's okay. You have to do many things. You have to not do many things. And non-Jews have only seven things. So the question is, I want to do more than what I'm commanded to do. What you're commanded to do, you have to do it. Whether you like it or not, we believe in God, etc., etc. But I want to do more things. Can I do it or not? So the Radvaz writes clearly, even though I don't have the text with me right now, the Radvaz writes, if a non-Jew wants to do other mitzvot, he can do it. He can do the thing. He can do it. No problem. As long as he does not do it because God commanded that he should do it. Because that's not true. God did not say you should do this. It's not written. You should do seven things. You want to do more? You can do it. As long as you're clear in your mind that you're not commanded to do it. Then the Radvaz comments on this idea of receiving reward. What kind of reward do you receive? God only gives rewards if he commands you to do something and you do it. So he gives you a reward. But if you're not supposed to do something and you do it, why should I give you a reward? I didn't ask you to do it. So the Radvaz writes, the reward is a lower level of reward, whatever that means. Nobody knows how to explain this, forget it. But it's a lower level of reward. Actually, this is not only in the Radvaz, this is also in the Zohar. It says, the Zohar is a book of Kabbalah. In the Zohar in Rut, it says that there's a Gan Eden, a paradise, whatever, reward for Jews, and there's a different Gan Eden, paradise for non-Jews. What's the difference? Nobody knows. It's not written anywhere. Forget it. You're not going to find it. You can look, but you're not going to find it. Nobody knows the difference. But whatever, this is the reward, whatever the reward is. So it's a lower level of reward. Why is it a lower level? Actually, sounds strange, because if you are commanded to do something, let's say we believe in God, thank God, there's one God, he commands many things, so I go and do it because I believe on him. Okay, so you get a reward. But if I am not commanded to do and I do more than what I'm commanded to do, apparently the reward should be higher. You're not supposed to be doing it, you're not obligated to do it, and you do it anyway. Great. What? Should be higher even if you're commanded to do it. So why is it a lower level of reward? To understand this, we need to know what a mitzvah, what a commandment means. The word mitzvah actually means commandment. It's an order. God says, and you go do it. However, when you go deeper a little bit in what a mitzvah means, mitzvah comes from the word Aramaic word tzavta, which means connection. It means a connection. We, as human beings, limited human beings, we cannot make a connection with the infinite, with God. We're nothing in front of him. He can make a connection with us, telling us, go do this for me, or don't do that because I say. So what's a mitzvah? A mitzvah is actually a connection. And that connection comes from him to us. It's like a one direction thing, from up, down. Given so, since this is so, if he commands you to do something and you do it, so you get the reward of the connection. The connection is the reward. But if he did not command to do and you do it anyway, who told you have a connection? Okay, you did something that is, let's call it nice in the eyes of God, whatever the case is. But you don't have the connection. So that's why the reward is lower. Should I say you have no connection at all? Okay, I'm not going to say that. I'm not going to say that. But do you have the same level of or kind of connection that you would have if you were commanded to do it? No. That's for sure you don't have it. This is what the Radvaz writes. Commenting on what the Rambam says, you can receive a reward. You want to do this because you want to receive a reward. So the Radvaz says, okay, but the reward is not the same as the reward for a Jew. It would be the same. Actually, this is what he writes. It's interesting. In Judaism, there are many commandments that men have to do and women are exempt. They don't have to do them. The reward that a woman receives when she makes a commandment that men should be doing is the same reward that a non-Jew receives when he makes a commandment that a Jew should be doing. It's the same level. It's the same. It's my idea. We're not saying here, Jews and not Jews. No. We're talking about an idea of commandment as connection. Since the Jewish woman is not obligated, let's say, to put on tefillin. Tefillin means phylacteries you put in the head. And there are Jewish women don't do it. Don't do it. There was only one that is recorded actually in the Talmud that she did it. Every day, she was Michal Bas Shaul. She was the wife of David HaMelech, one of the wives of David HaMelech. And nobody said anything to her because she was a very strong woman. So, shut up. Let her do whatever she wants. Don't say anything. But it's one case. Like, which woman today could say, I'm like Michal, the daughter of Shaul. Nobody does. Believe me. No women do this. So if she does it, let's suppose, whatever, she got crazy. She does it. What kind of reward does she receive? She was not commanded and she does it anywhere. It's a, anyway, it's a lower level of reward. Okay. So now we understand the Rambam, we understand the Radvaz. Okay. These are like primary sources. So let's go one step further. Many rabbis want to say that what the Rambam writes and what the Radvaz explain, it's not really literal. No, you cannot take it literally. They're not talking about any precept. No. They're only talking about whatever precept, whatever commandments make sense. What does that mean, make sense? There are many commandments in the Torah that you can see the utility that it has for the society. Like, don't steal. Okay. Besides the idea that God doesn't want us to steal for whatever reason, because he wants no stealing, besides that idea, there's the idea of, okay, we see actually this is a good thing. I don't steal you, you don't steal me, so we can live in peace and everybody's happy. I have my things, you have your things, we can share, whatever. I don't steal, you don't steal. Okay, we can live peacefully. And this is the main idea of the seven commandments for Bnei Noach, etc., to have a moral world, ethic world, peaceful world. That's good. That's fine. There are many commandments like that. Like, for instance, tzedakah, charity. It's not written that Bnei Noach should do charity. It's not written, no. But if a person wants to help somebody else, of course, makes perfect sense. I have money, you don't have money, I'm going to help you. Why not? Everybody's going to be happy. And God blesses me because I gave you, so everybody's happy, everything works. Even though it's not directly commanded, but he can do it. Makes sense. So there's an opinion. This opinion is recorded, actually it's his opinion, is recorded in the book Sheva Mitzvahs Hashem, the seven commandments, the divine code. In English it's called the divine code, by Rabbi Moshe Weiner, which is an amazing book. Has lots of notes in the Hebrew. I don't know the English part, but the Hebrew part is amazing. Amazing book. And he writes exactly this opinion. Bnei Noach should not do any other commandment rather than the seven commandments or anything that makes sense. What does that mean? Again, tzedakah, for instance, charity, or respect for father and mother. It's not written that they should do it. However, any person that has children or whatever, any adult, understands that you have to respect your father and your mother. You might like them more or less. Okay, that's a different story. Go to your psychologist and he's going to help you. But in any case, it makes sense. You have to respect whomever gave you life. Makes sense. So those kinds of commandments, Bnei Noach should do it, because they make sense. Okay, it's also written in the Torah. Very nice. But it's written for Jews. So non-Jews can also do it. This is his opinion. This is his opinion. So where do we see a difference? Where do we see a difference? In precepts, commandments that don't make any sense. For instance, kashrut. Kashrut means the laws of eating. There's only one source, one place in the Midrash, whatever. I'm not going to extract all the details. Whomever understands, fine. Whomever doesn't understand, it's okay. Don't worry. In the Midrash, it's written that God will give reward to those non-Jews that did not eat pork. That's what is written, whatever. So that means that all non-Jews should not eat pork? No. Is it forbidden to eat pork for non-Jews? No, it's not forbidden, not at all. Go enjoy yourself, whatever. Now, again, there's one source that says, okay, you want the reward, so don't eat the pork. That it doesn't make it a commandment not to eat pork. Why? Because actually all the laws of food for Jews do not make any sense. Zero. It's because God said, this animal is, I like it, this animal I don't like it. Doesn't make any sense. Afterwards, our sages try to find ideas. And for instance, the Ramban, Nachmanides, lived 100 years after the Rambam, also in Spain. The Ramban writes something interesting. That there are animals, those animals that the Torah prohibits, that have bad qualities inside. Cruelty, And for instance, he writes about the pork. Actually, the Midrash writes the pork. There are two signs whether animals could be kosher or not, earth animals. This is something everybody knows. It's written in the Torah. Has to be, I don't know the word in English, forget it. Many stomachs. I don't know how to say this in English. Has many, yeah, four stomachs, exactly. And has to have a split hoof. This one I know in English. But many stomachs, I don't know how to say in English. So has to have those two signs. Pork has only one stomach, like a regular human being, one stomach, but split hoofs. So the idea that our sages write about the pork, he shows himself like a kosher animal. Look, I have split hoofs. I'm nice. But on the inside, it's not kosher. It's not good. But you don't see it. You have to open it to see it, whatever. You don't see it. So it expresses it. The idea, and I'm not talking bad about the pork. Poor pork, it's okay. God created the pork, and whatever it does, it's okay. However, what it symbolizes, what it expresses is a person that is hypocrite. How do you say? He shows himself in one way, but it's actually in a different way. It's not good inside. It's not good outside. Everything looks nice, but inside it's not good. So, this is something. After the Torah says, don't eat the pork because of no reason, because we do not know the reason, our sages say, look, we found this idea. But it doesn't mean that everybody should not eat the pork because of this idea. No, not at all. Not at all. So, again, the difference would be in those commandments that do not make sense. If you ask Rabbi Weiner, he's going to tell you, don't do them. No, you cannot. If you ask the Rambam and the Radvaz in this other way of understanding it, and it's not me that understands it this way, there are other sources. I didn't quote them. Chasam Sofer, the Mishnah Berurah, whatever. There are other sources that understand this combination of Rambam and Radvaz, just as I explained. You can effectively do those precepts. If you ask them, you're gonna say yes. Go do it. You have to do it properly. Go ask a rabbi how to do it. You can do it. There are a few exceptions that even the Radvaz, when he writes his commentary on the Rambam, says this. He says, "Leave it megamig. My heart like makes noise. I don't like this idea." This is what he writes, that a non-Jew should put on tefillin. He says, "No, no way. I don't like this idea. A non-Jew should have or write a Sefer Torah, a book of the Torah." He says, "No, no. Or should have mezuzah in the door." And he says, "No, I don't like this idea. Those three, I don't like it." This is what he writes. Interesting. He doesn't say, "No, don't do it." He says, "I don't like it. I don't like the idea. My heart's like in Yiddish, you say mekishkes, like intestines, like remove and move. I don't like this idea." This is what he writes. Interesting. But the rest, yeah, why not? Yeah, why not? So if you go on the opinion of Rabbi Weiner, and he's also based on the other ideas. Okay, so you should not do anything else than what it's written for you. And if you have doubts, ask a rabbi. If it makes sense, if it's a commandment that makes sense, you can do it. And if it's a commandment that does not make sense, you should not do it. If you ask the other school of rabbis, so to speak, yeah, again, ask a rabbi whether really is for you or not, whether you should really do it or not. But there's room to say, yeah, go do it. And not only go do it, you're going to receive reward by doing it, which is like stronger, because I can say, whatever, you can do whatever you want. It doesn't make any sense. And God laughs at you and says, what is this guy doing? So, no, you're going to receive a reward. This is what the Rambam writes. This is what the Radvaz actually agrees with the Rambam. The Radvaz agrees with him. Now, once we understand what a commandment means, once we understand whether you can do it or not, the exceptions and the ideas, etc., there's another two points, very important points. And afterwards, after these two points, actually, I'm going to do it before. But there are two points. The Alter Rebbe, who's the founder of the Hasidic movement, Chabad, he has many thousands, literally, of pages, thousands and thousands of pages of Hasidic discourses, explaining all kinds of things, all kinds of things. There's one line, very interesting line, that he writes about a non-Jew putting on tefillin. He writes specifically about this. Even though in that line, we're not going to read the whole text, it's really complex and long, but in this line he writes, interesting, he's giving it an example. He's not exactly talking about non-Jews, and he's not talking about feeling like the commandment of feeling, no. He gives it as an example. But in this example, he uses the following idea. If a Jew, he says like this, if a Jew fulfills a mitzvah, a commandment, so he receives whatever the reward that corresponds to that mitzvah. Now, if he thinks all the laws about this commandment, and he knows all the Kabbalah, the mystics behind the command, everything, he knows everything, but he doesn't do it, so it doesn't work. Nothing happens. That's what he's right. Nothing happens. And this is the interesting thing. It is as if you have that feeling in your table. You did not put it on. You have to put it in your head, in your arm. You left it in the table, and you look at them and say, wow, feeling means A, B, C, D, woo, amazing things. You didn't do it. So it doesn't make, there's no result in the world. And then he writes, the same thing happens if a non-Jew puts on the tefillin. Nothing happens in the world. There's no result in the world. This is what he writes. It's interesting. Nothing happens. I don't know, and I'm not, again, an authority to say, the same applies to all other commandments, or he was talking specifically about tefillin. I don't know. I'm not an authority, but I do know, and I just read it to you, the Rambam clearly says, if you want to do other commandments, go ahead, do it properly again, ask a rabbi and do it properly. But go ahead and do it. Is it the same reward as a Jew? No, but it is a reward. There is a reward. Yes? Okay, this is one point about the Alter Rebbe, like a little bit more mystic things behind it. And this gives, like opens a different realm. There's another Hasidic discourse that I shared it actually with Rabbi Weiner. I shared the discourse, and he said to me, through a different person, Michael, he said to me, look, I don't think this is something you should actually share with everybody. But to me, like the Radvaz writes, my intestines are moving, you know, why not? If we have a great sage that wrote this, and it is like available, why not? Why not sharing it? Who wrote this? This is something that wrote the Rebbe Maharaj. Rebbe Maharaj is the fourth Hasidic Rebbe of Chabad. Shmuel, that was his name. He lived in Lubavitch, a small town, very small place, there in the south of Russia. And he writes in one discourse that actually afterwards is taken by one of his sons, that was the fifth Rebbe of Chabad, Rebbe Rashab. And he actually mentions this also, that when the first man, Adam Arishon, that of course is the father of everybody, we're all his children, when Adam Arishon when the first man was kicked out of the paradise, the reason why he was kicked out of the paradise is because God wanted the whole world to be refined. If he stayed specifically, I'm not going to enter in the argument, I'm sorry that I interrupt, but I'm not going to enter in the argument, did he do right, wrong, he ate? Okay, let's leave that for a different time. But the reality, the thing is, the story is, he was kicked out. Okay, if he would have stayed in the paradise, the whole world wouldn't have been a refined place. The whole world would have been a terrible place. And God didn't want this. So he was kicked out. Like, this is part of the plan. Interesting. He was kicked out, and by doing this, God gave him a mission to him and to all his children, and I include non-Jews on all his children. God gave him a mission. The mission is to refine the world. How do you refine the world? Well, okay, there are two answers. Answer number one, by doing commandments. When you do, for instance, we're talking about tefillin. So you take the tefillin. Actually, what are they made of? They're made of cow, the leather of the cow, and the ink, and all kinds of materials. When you actually fulfill a commandment with those materials, you elevate. This is called in Hebrew, birurim, refinements. For whatever, whomever knows, this is what it's called, birurim. Avoidance of birurim, the work of refinement of the whole world. How do you refine the world? By doing commandments with the world. Now, where is the rest, so to speak, actually the majority of all the children of Adam, of the first man? Jews are a very, very small minority. How do you expect them to refine the whole world? It's impossible. So how do you do that? Everybody, Jews and non-Jews, have to use the world, I mean the material world, in order to serve God. When you eat something, okay, so you're taking vegetables or a cow, or whatever you're eating, doesn't matter, and you're using this to have strength, to pray, to be kind with other people, to disseminate morality, ethics, etc., etc., etc. So that food becomes a refined thing, a godly thing. This is what it means, actually, refined, godly thing. We reveal God in the world by using the world to serve him. How do you reveal God? Because when you take a piece of food and you make a blessing, the idea, the main idea of the blessing is to recognize that this food actually belongs to God and he wants me to reveal him in the world. So when I say the blessing, I actually recognize myself, and I teach anybody who's watching me or hearing me, whatever, that there's a God, he's the creator of the world, he gave us food, he wants us to eat, because if I don't eat, I die. He wants us to eat, but before eating, he wants us to recognize that actually everything belongs to him. He created everything. This is what it means, revealing God by eating. You're going to ask, hey, wait, if I do a commandment, I reveal God, whatever. But eating, yeah, by eating, you can reveal God. And you can make the eating itself service to God. So this is what the Rebbe Maharash, not in this exact words, whatever, this is what the Rebbe Maharash writes in that discourse. The first man was kicked out of the Gan Eden, of the paradise, to refine the whole world. And everybody has a mission, everybody has a specific mission into this idea of refinement of the world. I live wherever I live, you live wherever you live, and we reveal God in those places. And in our way of being, way of talking, whatever. The same thing, same idea, exactly same idea, appears actually in the Torah itself. God told Moses to write the Torah in 70 languages when the Jews were about to enter the land, etc. Why should he write in 70 languages? Today there are more than 70 languages, it doesn't matter, but for what? All the Jews that were there, they all knew Hebrew, they all knew the Torah, so to speak, they had it to read it. Why do you need it in 70 languages? Who spoke those languages? Nobody. I mean, from the Jews that received the Torah over there, nobody spoke those languages. Maybe Egyptian, whatever, some guys that remember still Egyptian after 40 years. Why do you need it for? In the commentaries, Rashi brings this as a commentary, in one of the main commentaries, he says, for the other nations. So there's an idea of other nations learning Torah. Okay, we can discuss which part yes, which part no. Okay, it's a different discussion, but there is such an idea. And there is such an idea of sharing the message of Judaism for everybody. Everybody. Everywhere. Okay. So this is what the Rebbe Maharash writes about Birurim. So the same thing we could say, again, I'm not an authority, but we could say that by fulfilling certain commandments that are actually for Jews, but you're a non-Jew that wants to fulfill those commandments, there is probably, I underline the word probably, because I'm not an authority on mystics to say, etc., etc., there is some refinement over there. Yeah, the Rebbe writes about feeling. A non-Jew putting on feelings like a tefillin in the table is the same thing. But again, maybe only a place to tefillin. I don't know. I don't know. And the Rambam clearly writes, you can fulfill mitzvot and you receive some reward. So there is some refinement in the world. But again, every case has to be presented to a rabbi that understands what you're talking about. And the rabbi should be able to give you guidance on whether you should do this or not. Okay, next step. There are other precepts, other commandments that are not written in the Torah. And those commandments are rabbinic commandments. There are seven, actually, rabbinical commandments. One of them, for instance, that we spoke about is blessings. In the Torah itself, in the text itself, there's only one blessing. that is recited after the meals. There's a whole text, or whatever, that has to be recited. That it's appropriate to mention, even though we're not talking about this particular thing, but the text that is written for Jews does not make any sense for a non-Jew to read. It doesn't make any sense at all. And if you read it, just take the Siddur, the praying book of a Jew, and read it, and you're gonna see, hey, this is not talking about me. What am I reading? Like, God gave us the land, and God gave us the Torah, and God gave us this sign, and what are you reading? Sounds very nice, grace after meals, but the text itself doesn't make any sense. So there are texts for non-Jews. I mean, you can say, and you should say, grace after meals, a blessing before the meals, definitely, but not the same text. Doesn't make any sense. The blessing before the meals usually is the same for Jews and non-Jews. Makes sense. That text makes sense. So what I want to say with this is, and I close like the parentheses, I'm not talking about blessings now, but what I want to say with this is, things have to have a common sense. If you're just doing things because you're doing things, doesn't make any sense. It's like a circle, but whatever. It doesn't make sense. What are you doing? It's like, I was born in Argentina. I'm an Argentinian. And I thank God that he made me an American. I mean, United States. It's not true. I was not born there. I'm not American. I was born in Argentina. So what am I saying? Why should I recite blessing to God because he made me whatever, something he did not make me? Doesn't make sense. Okay. We close like the parenthesis. But blessings is one of the seven rabbinical commandments. Other two of those commandments are Hanukkah and Purim. The idea that actually fired this whole class was, for me, I was supposed to be talking about Hanukkah, and it's been 45 minutes talking about something else, but whatever. that's what you got. Those two are stories that happen. The stories actually very known and very easy to find anywhere. You can do Hanukkah, what's Hanukkah, even Wikipedia, which is not actually a good source, but whatever, some things are right. Yeah, you can find over there what's the whole story. Just very, very, very briefly, the story of Purim actually happened before Hanukkah. Purim happened around 350 years before Common Era, and Hanukkah happened around 150 years before the Common Era. Both before the Common Era. Around that. Purim is about the destruction, after the destruction of the First Temple, Jews were in Persia and whatever is Iran today. And the whole story with Esther, the queen, and Mordechai. Okay, you can read the story, you can read the book of Esther. It's very, very easy. After that story, the next year, our sages said, let's celebrate this. Was a great miracle, let's celebrate. And there are very specific ways in which we Jews celebrate Purim. You have to read a text in the night, in the morning. Okay, so there's a whole thing how to celebrate Purim. Hanukkah, pretty much the same idea. The second temple was built, but the Syrian Greeks conquered the land, and they didn't destroy the temple, they just entered and then made a whole mess in the temple. And there was a group of Jews, Maccabees, that's what they were called, and they recovered control of Eretz Israel, the land of Israel, the temple. They cleaned the place, they wanted to light the menorah, the candelabra. They didn't find oil, there was a miracle over there. Okay, you can find the text and ideas in anywhere, actually, today. Anyway, you don't need me to tell the story. And afterwards, next year, our sages also said, hey, let's celebrate this. It's interesting that every time Jews suffer, we get a new Yom Tov, we get a new party. It's interesting. Actually, today is the 10th of Kislev, or the month of Kislev. It's also a party because the second Chabad rabbi, Mittel Rebbe, was called Doiber, was imprisoned, which is also a whole thing in itself. It's interesting that in Chabad, it doesn't happen the same thing in other movements, other Jewish movements. In Chabad, almost, except for one, our Rebbe, the rest all were imprisoned, all were in jail. So we're, you know, good guys. You have good rabbis. All we're in jail. All have like a thing, I don't know what it's called in English, prontuarios in Spanish, like a whole story of being in jail. Good guys. Okay, so today actually celebrates that he was liberated from prison. The year 1826, many years ago. So whatever, okay. So every time we have suffering, we have a new party. That's what Purim and Hanukkah mean, basically. Those are rabbinical festivities, rabbinical celebrations. Should Bnei Noach do them or not? Okay, so let's put things into place. If you ask the Rambam and the Raivad, the way we understood it, like we read this, the sources, etc., they're going to say, yeah, why not? Why not? If you can actually refrain yourself from eating something you're not supposed to, refrain yourself, but it's okay. Or you can give tzedakah, or you can, whatever, do other commandments. Why not Hanukkah? Why not Purim? Be happy. Go do them. But if you ask Rabbi Weiner, the way I understand it, he should say, no, don't do this. What's the meaning? Does it really make sense? Because you light candles in your house. Are you going to make anything better in the world? If you help somebody else, you give them money, you give them advice, whatever. So you're actually increasing goodness in the world. But if you light candles in your house, what are you increasing? Okay, you can say light. Okay, light is a symbol of goodness and light and the light of Torah and the light of whatever. You could say this, but the same thing you could do anywhere, any day. Tonight, go and light candles. Why not? Or light 10 candles, 200 candles. What difference does it make? If you want to make light, so go make light. You say the light has a symbol. Okay, that's fine. It's not wrong, but it doesn't have anything to do with Hanukkah. And one more step. This is my humble opinion. I did not see this written anywhere. But both Hanukkah and Purim, I understand that they mean the prevalence of goodness over bad. That's okay. But after all, for a non-Jew, should sound weird. Because Jews are actually celebrating, hey, we defeated non-Jews. So wait a second, if I'm non-Jew, why should I celebrate that these guys defeated, I don't know. To me, doesn't make sense. But this is my own problem. I make it very clear. I did not see this written anywhere. So again, should non-Jews celebrate Hanukkah? Depends on who you ask. And depends on what are you actually understanding when you do this. I'm not saying you should not, but depends on who you ask. I don't know if you have questions, if you have comments, I'm open. Yes.
As I understand it, was also because of when it is commanded, when the mitzvah is commanded, it's more difficult to do the mitzvah because of the evil inclination people have, so they will have to be more strong to do the mitzvah. That's I thought that was also the reason that we want for non Jews is lower because it's easier to do.
It's interesting. The idea is definitely interesting. I don't know. Because if you want to delve into that, it gets really difficult to understand. Because what's the evil inclination? We all, human beings, all of us, and it's actually written in the Torah also, in the end of the Bereshit, of the first parsha, of the first section of the Torah, and also in Parshat Noach, like the heart of man is evil from when he's born. This is what is written. So this applies to everybody. We're all in the same boat, so to speak. But there's a thing that is called Nefesh HaElokis, a divine soul, that is something that the Alter Rebbe writes, Jews have, and non-Jews don't have. This does not mean at all that non-Jews don't have a soul. No, 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 no. It's a different kind of thing. It's a different kind of soul that besides, on top of the human soul that we all have, I'm not an animal and you're not an animal either. You're human beings. An animal is an animal, whatever. It's a dog, it's a cat, and it's okay. But on top of the human soul we all have, Jews have a different thing. So, a different soul. It's called Nefesh Elokis, a divine soul, whatever. So, that's where it gets the fight between the animal soul and the divine soul. This is called, this is all explained very, very greatly in Tanya, in the work of the Alter Rebbe, the first chapters, and then he goes on until chapter 18, and there's a whole long thing. But I don't know if the conflict of a Ben Noyach, Bas Noyach, within itself, in the good part and the bad part that every human being has, it's different than the conflict that the Jew has between his divine soul and the animal soul. I don't know. Because after all, God says, don't steal to you and to me. Don't steal. Okay. If I see money over there and I say, wow, nobody's watching me. Why not? Everybody has this conflict. Baruch Hashem, thank God. Many people say, no, it's not mine. I'm not going to touch it. Forget it. Baruch Hashem, you're in the good boat, so to speak. You're okay. But the temptation, actually, is a temptation for everybody. Why not? What difference does it make whether you're Jew or non-Jew? Temptation is temptation. So I don't know if the conflict is different to say that's why the Jew has more reward and the Jew has less reward. We both have conflicts. Okay, maybe different levels, maybe different kinds of conflicts that are really different, so different. I don't know.
But there is also the idea that when Noahites perform the seven mitzvot, you can do it by logic, and you can do it because Hashem told you so, because of he told the people to do that by Moses at Mount Sinai. Then it's more like a commandment, and then the reward is on a higher level than when you just do it because it's logic, because then it's not something you really have to do. It's not really in commandments, so to speak.
Yeah, there's a text of the Rambam on this point precisely. The Rambam writes that in that chapter number 10, of the Laws of Kings, the Rambam writes at the end, I think it's at the end, okay, I don't remember if it's at the end or the beginning, it doesn't matter. The Rambam writes over there that a non-Jew that fulfills his seven commandments, because God told Moses in Mount Sinai to tell the Jews to spread out the word, whatever, so that has a chelek lelamabo, has a portion in the world to come. This is what the Rambam writes. But if he does it because his mind is a clear mind and a good mind and says, I'm not going to steal. Why? Because my parents didn't teach me this. I'm a good guy. I'm not stealing. Forget it. So there are two versions of what the Rambam wrote about this. It's not clear. And there's a whole long explanation by the Rebbe of the two versions of the Rambam. It's an interesting study in itself. The Rambam, again, there are two versions. What did he write? So I'm going to tell you both. I don't know which one he wrote because nobody knows. But one version of the Rambam says that if he does it because of intelligence, because this makes sense, it's not a portion in the world to come, but he's a wise man. So wise man, because a wise man, a mind that works properly, is going to tell you not to steal. That's the right thing to do. This is one version of the Rambam. The other version of the Rambam says, look, if you fulfill the commandments because your mind tells you, so you are not part of the wise men of the world. This is what he writes. You are not part of the wise men. You don't get a portion on the water column, forget it, because you only do it because you think it's right, and you're not even wise. This is what the, nobody knows which one the Rambam actually wrote. There are two versions. Let's go ask the Rambam. Let's bring Mashiach, and then he's going to resurrect, and we got to ask him, which one do you write? But there's a whole long explanation by the Rebbe on these two versions. So, again, the level of reward that a person gets when he does it, this definitely, when he does it because his mind tells you to do it, not because God told Moses, etc., definitely lower, very lower than the reward that he gets because when he does it because God told Moses, etc., etc. Definitely. Yeah.
My question is, yeah. What does it mean when we say a Jew has a divine soul? What does that mean? And also, if that Jew been born with a divine soul, after you have explained it, that Jew grew up to become an atheist or secular, and you know, all these things, how does that affect that status, that person's soul? Could you explain?
Very, very interesting questions. Okay, now point number one, the Alter Rebbe, which is the source, so to speak, of that idea. It's in the Zohar also, but the Alter Rebbe expresses it like very clearly of the idea of divine soul. He writes, he uses a verse of Eov, Job, I think it's called in English, one of the last books of the Bible, whatever. He writes, Chelek Eloka Mimal, is a portion of God above. And the Alter Rebbe writes, Mamish, literally a portion of God above. What does it mean, a portion of God? Don't ask me. I don't know. But this is what he writes. And this is the definition of the divine soul. Why do we say literally? Because it expresses in the physical world. It has a expression, has an effect in the physical world. That's, again, on top of what is called, actually, in the text of the Torah at the beginning, the first parsha, when God creates man, it says, Tzelem Elohim Atzeret Adam, with the image of God, whatever that means, God made man, women, again, it's the same. So there's the image of God, and there's the divine soul. What is the divine soul? There's no, believe me, I didn't learn everything. I know that. But there's not one place that actually defines this in the Hasidic writings, because it's impossible to define it. Just as we cannot define God, like fully define him, impossible, the same way we cannot define a part of him. And if we're going to call the divine soul a part of God, forget it. You're not going to be able to define it. You can define its effects. You can define how it actually expresses itself in the body, in the world. But what it is, impossible. Impossible to define. This is not the same. This is an example which is not perfect. I agree, it's not perfect. It's just an idea. Like ancient science, magnetism, they didn't know what it was. Like there's a force over there, like doing strange things. When you put a rock over here and a metal over here, wow, one attracts the other one. So we cannot define what it is. Afterwards, science explained how it works and what it is and which materials actually have it, which materials don't have it. Okay, but at the beginning was something undefinable, something impossible to define. Why is it not a perfect example? Because the soul, after all, is again a portion of God. God is undefinable, so the soul is also undefined. Now, regarding the second question, a very interesting question. Judaism is a one-way ticket. What does that mean? When a Jew is born Jew, he's always going to remain a Jew. And when a non-Jew converts, always going to remain a Jew. There's no way back. There's no way out, and there's no way back. It doesn't matter what you do or you don't do, you're always a Jew. Never going to change. Never going to change. Because that's a condition that we, as human beings, don't impose. We get from God. And just as God doesn't change, our condition doesn't change. Never. It's impossible. So it doesn't really matter what the person thinks, how the person acts. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. And the same thing is interesting. I said it, but to make it clear, the point, same thing does not happen to non-Jews. Because maybe you were born as a non-Jew, but if you convert, you become a Jew. And then you're not, no way back, okay? But you can change the condition of non-Jew. I'm not saying everybody has to convert. No. This is not the message. I'm not saying this. It is possible. Yeah, of course. Talk to a rabbi. He's going to tell you how to do it, when to do it, etc., etc. Okay, that's a different subject. But non-Jews can change their condition, definitely, and become Jews. Yeah?
So, Rabbi, so it goes to mean that a non-Jew who converts will have a divine soul.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes, definitely.
So it is really a, I'm trying to say if it is a spiritual condition or a gift. Because that divine soul must, I believe it is something that a spark that is ready to increase in its intensity, or you know, something that is dormant in a Jew who is not obedient to Torah, who is ignorant to Torah, but that spark still remains, that life is there, that fire is there, ready to be ignited by becoming close to Hashem, by even the observance of one from one.
I'm laughing while you talk, because what you're saying, I wish, I really wish that many, many Jews, now I'm talking about Jews, not non-Jews, I wish many, many Jews would listen to you and we would appreciate what you're saying. What you're saying is, hey, the condition of being Jew is a gift that God gave you. I wish, again, I repeat this, that many Jews would actually understand this. You got it. You understood it. I wish other people got it. Now, let's go back. Your question is still a good question. Hey, oh, okay, you changed my screen. Let's go back. I'm sorry that I got like excited because you put the right words in the right place, you know? No. It is a gift. It is a gift, but there are two parts to this. One part is the gift that, like, it's a whole thing in the Talmud also. You have to deserve a gift, actually, because the person that gives you a gift doesn't give a gift to anybody. He gives you a gift because he likes you. That's why he gives you a gift. So there's some kind of I deserve it on a gift also. But let's say, not to complicate things, let's say a gift comes from above. You don't deserve it, you got a gift. Oh, there you go. You got a gift. This is one part of the idea of conversion. But the other part of the idea of conversion is, after all, this non-Jew decided to convert. Because he could have sat home and watched TV and whatever. The world continues functioning. I don't need to be Jewish. So there's an intellectual idea that the person said, based on this, and that, and based on, I want to convert, and I'm going to convert, and I'm going to call the rabbi, and I'm going to go forth, and whatever time it takes, whatever the process is, doesn't matter. I'm going to do it. You took the decision. Nobody forced you to convert. There's no such a thing in Judaism. There's no such a thing. Okay, so there are two things. It's either, if it's a gift, it's something that came from above, like forced upon you. I got this. I was born a Jew, so I didn't take any decision. On the other hand, I make the decision, I'm going to convert. So how do you put these two things together? Okay, there's a very interesting text when our sages write, it's called the Mishnah, the Talmud, whatever, all our texts, when they talk about conversion, they say the expression, I'm going to say it in Hebrew, and then I'm going to have to translate, Gershon is Geyer. Gershon is Geyer, it's a very weird expression, because the translation would be a convert that converts. What do you mean Gershon is Geyer? if he's a convert, he's not converting. He's already converted. And so what are you saying? You should say a non-Jew that converts. Okay, fine, non-Jew that converts. The idea would be ba ba ba. Okay, whatever the case is. What does that mean? A Gershon is Gaia. A convert that converts. What is that? So there's a text, Chido, it's called Chaim Yosef David Azulay, years 1700s, end of 1700s. He writes a very interesting explanation. He says like this, look, when a non-Jew, any non-Jew, converts, the truth is he already had the soul. He already had the gift. The way you call it with your words, and I love your words. You already have the gift. Now, you have to actually show it, like bring it forth, because for whatever reason you were born non-Jew, I don't know, only God knows. So now you have to make a process, whatever the process is, call the rabbi and he's going to tell you. And you have to reveal that you actually have this soul, but you had it inside. Now, once I said this, I have to say something that's very important, very important. I'm a very simple person. I'm no Kabbalist or anything, whatever. Very simple person. But there are many, many guys around that play with this. And in a wrong way, play with this. And they end up extracting money by playing with this. Because you have a soul and this and that. And you already have it. And I see you by watching at your face. And the background where you're sitting, I see that you actually have the soul inside. And come to my classes and I'm going to help you. Oh, and your class, yeah, you have to give me this money. Oh, okay, because you have the soul already, I'm going to help you. Wait a second. Nobody, not even a guy who learns the whole day sitting in Yerushalayim, can tell you what is your soul. There's no such thing today. The Arizal in the 1500s in Sfas, okay, the Arizal knew. He, just one guy in the whole story. Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, also the Zayar says about him, okay, two guys, in the whole story of the mankind, two guys. Nobody can sell you, actually, I wanted to say tell you, but actually sell you this. Nobody should sell you this. No, don't buy. Never knows. Nobody knows. The only thing we know is, okay, tell me who your mother is, what, whatever the case is. And let's see, is she Jewish? Was she Jewish? Yes, no. Do you have papers? So you're Jewish. You don't have papers? I'm so sorry, you are not Jewish. You want to convert? Fine, I'm going to help you. But papers are papers. I mean, the reality is real. No soul talking here, no mystic things. And no. Don't come to me with this. No. Thank you for your question, because you got me... Yeah.
Hello, Rabbi. Yes, well, to make sure, because I did quite some study on the Nefesh Elyona and the Nefesh Tachtoina.
Yeah.
Because I help with problems. I used to have problems, you know. So it's my main motto is Moach Shelita Halev, right? So I came to, through this study, I came to a certain rabbi, and he has great knowledge, so I find. And I learned that, you can also call it Nefesh Behamis, right? Which resides in the blood, which is the animal soul, which everyone has for its basic needs.
Yeah.
Right? But I learned that even Goyim, the Gentiles, have four or five parts of the Nefesh Elyona. Because it's only the part, the fifth, the Yechida, which we don't have, which affects the Tzimtzum, and which is connected to the possibility of bringing us to Olam Haba. It's only this part of the divine soul, because if we wouldn't have this divine soul and some part of it, we would be running around like animals. So, so I don't.
Interesting. I would have to watch the source.
From it. So I just wanted to mention that, because I know, and that brings me to the next thing. All the things I observe in Judaism are so great, and even the mitzvah for the Jews, which some of them are broke, of which you don't understand what it's for, it gets you thinking, because it's, for instance, a pig, right? A boar, he's not able to look up, so
yeah.
Look,
and Hashem, right? And they hear all kinds of stories about parasites and health, and wasn't it Hashem's intention to keep the Jews alive forever, right? And all during all time, many people will fall, many nations will fall, but these Jews, they need to stay alive. So, so my point is, many of these mitzvot must have some also have like health reasons, like the washing of the hands,
yeah,
which I always do with the prayer. I change the prayer. I say, you commanded the Jews, which I
you made your own blessing.
Out of my prayer, right? To not what you said, to not change it. But my question, is it possible to help as a non-Jew, to help another Jew to come to do more? To help Jews, right, by motivating, by showing that what they do is appreciated, by translating, whatever kind of things, you know. So is it possible to be of service to Jews?
Sure,
to
definitely, them? Definitely, yes. Definitely, yes. Definitely, yes. And regarding the other thing that you said, I invite you to read Shmona Prakim. It's the introduction of the Rambam, to Pirkei Avos, to his commentary on the Mishnah on Pirkei Avot. It's available in Sepharia. You can find it. It's not an easy text at all. Not at all. It talks about many kinds of souls and parts of the souls. It's not a mystic. No, it doesn't talk about Nefesh, Ruach, Neshama, Chaya, Yechida. No. It's a different world, philosophic world, whatever. It talks about that. And I would definitely love to read whatever source you have where it said that the Jews also have Nefesh, Ruach, Neshama, Chaya, but don't have Yechida. I don't know. I would love to read it. Yeah. So if you have it, you can, whatever, send it to Angelique and she sends it to me or whatever case. And we can discuss it, no problem. I didn't see it, but
yeah.
Okay, very good. All right. I think we're going today. I have to go.
So thank you very much. We learned a lot. It was a good shiur.
Baruch Hashem.
Thank you.
Baruch Hashem. Thank you for being there. And God willing, we'll see each other. Bye-bye.